And we're going to look verses 15 through 22 tonight here. This is just part of the author of Hebrews, part of his argument on the superiority of Jesus, his priesthood, the superiority of his sacrifice, and the superiority of the new covenant over the old covenant. I'm going to go ahead and read verses 15 through 22. "And for this reason he is the mediator of a new covenant, in order that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. For where a covenant is, there must be of necessity be the death of the one who made it. For a covenant is valid only when men are dead, for it is never enforced while the one who made it lives. Therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves and the goats, with water and scarlet wool and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, 'This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you.' And in the same way he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with the blood. And according to the law, one may almost say, all things are cleansed with blood. And without shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness." Well, we've seen here in chapter 8 how the author of Hebrews expanded or explained the new covenant, calling it in chapter 8, verse 6, a more excellent ministry. It's a better covenant made on better promises. And then he's expounding on that in chapter 9, where he's showing that the Old Covenant sanctuary, the Old Covenant sacrifices, these are growing old, ready to disappear, becoming obsolete. And this is, and so in chapter 9, verses 1 through 10, we saw where the author of Hebrews, he describes what was the Old Covenant sanctuary, and he describes the tent of meeting that was Moses built and constructed in the wilderness, and what the sacrifices are under or were under the Old Covenant, and how it was all by the high priest, and then only the high priest could enter the Holy of Holies. Only the high priest could have this access to God, and even that access was an exception. It was only on one day a year, and he could not have this access, or could only obtain it with blood. He had to take blood, not only for his sins, but for the sins of the people as well. But then he talks about Jesus, which we saw last time, verses 11 through 14, that when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, that he entered this more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. In other words, it's a tabernacle in the heavens. It's more perfect in the sense that it's complete. It's not earthly. And he didn't do it through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood. And so we see here the superiority of Jesus' sacrifice over the Old Covenant sacrifice. And that was that the Old Covenant sacrificial system, all it did was provide external ceremonial cleansing. As verse 13 says, that the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkle those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh. See, that's all there was. And then he gave the lesser to the greater argument, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve a living in God. So, this is what was required to be without blemish ceremonially, was this animal sacrifice. And it was the sacrifice, involuntary sacrifice, of these dumb animals. They didn't know what was happening. Well, now, this would all be okay if all of man's problems were merely external, and all that was required was external cleansing up. But the problem is internal. The problem is with the heart. The problem is with the attitude. It's with our disposition to God. See, that's where the real problem lies. And so there has to be this internal cleansing, not just a superficial external ceremonial cleansing. And unfortunately, this is what so much of Christianity today, or what goes my term of Christianity focuses on, is just this external cleansing, cleaning of people up on the outside. Even what we were just talking about here a few minutes ago about this let's take America back for God type of thing has more to do with an external cleansing, creating a more moral society, a society more in keeping with God's commandments. But that doesn't touch the inward part. That doesn't clean up the inside and bring internal cleansing. Because if the inside is clean, then the outside is going to take care of itself. But the problem's internal. And the Old Covenant sacrifice, it couldn't cleanse internally. It could only cleanse the flesh. This is why, again, in verse 14, he says, how much more the blood of Christ, it frees from this inward blemish. It cleanses the conscience. And that's because Jesus offered a perfect sacrifice. Some people try to, or there's a terminology within theology that distinguishes between Jesus' obedience during his earthly life and Jesus' obedience to the law, keeping the law, fulfilling the will of God is often termed as Jesus' active obedience. And then they'll talk about Jesus' passive obedience, which is obedience unto death, his suffering on the cross. Well, there's really nothing passive about any of Jesus' obedience. It all involved an active determination of his will to do the will of the Father. But it's this, what's often termed active obedience, is keeping the law, this perfect life. You have perfect blood. It's a perfect sacrifice. It's untainted with sin. You had someone who was inwardly perfect, inwardly unblemished, that satisfies God's holy will and God's righteous requirements and meets man's need. Yeah, remember over in Mark chapter 7, Jesus talked about how there's nothing outside of man that can defile him. You know, I've had people tell me that they think smoking is so terrible, and it's not what enters a man that defiles him, it's what comes out of the man. You know, some people treat smoking as though it's an unpardonable sin. But there's nothing outside of us that can defile us. It's all inward. That defilement comes from inward. Isn't this what Jesus said? You know, it's not what that enters the man that defiles him, what comes out. Because it's from the heart that all these sins come from. The greed, the lust, the fornications, the idolatries, the murders, all these come from within the heart. And so the need is all inward. The need is spiritual, not a physical purification. Over in 1 Peter, Peter emphasizes this as well in his letter. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18, Christ also died for sins, once for all, the just for the unjust, and that he might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit. And then he makes an analogy with during the times of Noah. And then in verse 21 he says, and corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. Not the removal of dirt from the flesh. See, we're not talking about an external cleansing here. We're not talking about a religious ritual like being sprinkled with blood that's going to cleanse you, but an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. See, that's what it cleanses the conscience. So people who hold to baptismal regeneration really put baptism on the same level as Old Testament sacrificial system. It's it almost becomes what is referred to in Roman Catholicism. When you talk about the sacraments in Roman Catholicism, or the way they view the sacraments, especially communion, as means of grace, there's a Latin term for it that's ex opere operato, which means that The sacrament in and of itself is what does the cleansing. So in Roman Catholicism, people hold the baptismal regeneration. It is the very act of baptism itself that is efficacious. It is the act itself through which God's grace works to cleanse the person. It is the means through which they receive the grace. But author of Hebrews is telling us, you know, we've got a better sacrifice in this. The conscience is purified by the work of Christ. And so we worship Christ in spirit and truth. We're cleansed from dead works, we're told in verse 14. These dead works, and these dead works are not the ritualism. The dead works are the practices, the attitudes that pollute the soul, that defile the soul. That's what we're cleansed from by His sacrifice. And so, in verse 15, He states, and for this reason. See, it's by His sacrifice. By reason of His sacrifice. Well, what does He mean for this reason? What reason is He talking about? Well, it's everything He's just delineated in verses 11 through 14. In fact, verse 15 is just kind of a summary of everything He said in verses 11 through 14. It's by this sacrifice that Jesus is the mediator of a new covenant. See, we're already told this over in chapter 8, verse 6, that He's obtained a more excellent ministry, by as much as He is also the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises. But He doesn't tell us there in chapter 8 how Jesus became the mediator of this better covenant. And that's what He's going to be telling us now. See, Jesus' sacrifice inaugurated the new covenant. And we're told this throughout the Bible, aren't we? Remember, just in the institution of the Lord's Supper, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Jesus stated this. It was His sacrifice that inaugurated the new covenant. And so verse 15 just summarizes verses 11 through 14. He is the mediator. And He tells us the reason He's the mediator, in order that. And to get to the reason, we got to skip through a few words here. We could skip right to the word those. For this reason, He's the mediator of a new covenant, in order that those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. See, that's the reason He's a mediator. God is people He has called. And these called people are to receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. They don't receive just the promise, they receive what is in the promise, this eternal inheritance. Well, what is this eternal inheritance? Well, it's the blessings, it's the mercies that were described in the new covenant in Jeremiah 31:31, that God will take away their heart of stone, give them a heart of flesh, write the law on their heart, that He will not remember their sins any longer. It's a new covenant, not like the covenant that I made with them in the wilderness, a covenant that they broke, but this is a unilateral, an unqualified, irrevocable covenant. And Jesus is the mediator of this. For the purpose that those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. See, Jesus' sacrifice did what the old covenant sacrifice could not do. So it's said that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant. See, there was no death in the Old Testament, in the Old Covenant, that could redeem, that could provide redemption for transgressions, for the violations of the Mosaic Law. See, the author of Hebrews here is writing to Jewish Christians. They understand that a violation of the law has a penalty. And that penalty is separation from God. The penalty for breaking a covenant is death. And they're not redeemed from this. They can't be redeemed from this simply by blood, the blood of the bulls and the goats. See, Israel made a covenant with God. Over in Exodus 24, we see this covenant enacted by Moses. And in verse 3, after Moses, in verse 3 of Exodus 24, then Moses came, recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances. So he told them all this. He read them all this. Not just the Ten Commandments, but all the other ordinances and stipulations relating to their everyday conduct and life. And how did the people respond? The people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken we will do. And again in verse 8, Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. And again in verse 7, they say, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, we will be obedient. This is the covenant they entered into with God, to be obedient to this covenant. But they violated that covenant. They transgressed the covenant. They broke it. And the penalty for breaking a covenant is death. But here, we have one where death has taken place for the redemption of these transgressions. It's a new covenant, and it's applied to those who have been called. See, this word redemption, the connotation of ransom cannot be... People have tried, theologians have tried down through decades to try to remove the notion of ransom from the word redemption. And you can't do it. You can't do it etymologically. You can't do it linguistically. You can't do it in any way. The idea of redemption always holds the idea of ransom, of being purchased. It's a liberation procured by purchase of a ransom, by the payment of a ransom. So we've been redeemed, ransomed from this death by Jesus. He's the mediator. And it's costly. It's extremely costly. Over in Psalms, Psalm 49, 8. There's this psalm talking about the futility of riches. And in verse 5 it says, why should I fear in days of adversity when the iniquity of my foes surrounds me? Even those who trust in their wealth and boast in the abundance of their riches, no man can by any means redeem his brother or give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of his soul is costly, and he should cease trying forever, that he should live on eternally, that he should not undergo decay. In other words, this whole concept that you can atone for somebody else, or that you can do enough to try to ransom somebody from the consequences of covenant disobedience, from death, that you're going to live forever, give it up. It's a costly, costly redemption. Something the old covenant could never do. And so this mediator, Jesus, he's the mediator of a new covenant. And as mediator of the new covenant, this eternal inheritance that's been promised is guaranteed for all who have been called. Again, over in chapter 3, verse 1, we are told that he's addressing holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling. And in chapter 5, verse 9, we are told that Jesus, having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation. See, it's an eternal salvation, guaranteed from the foundation of the world. and it's guaranteed for all who have been called. Well, so this is a summary of verses 11 through 14. It tells us the benefits, the how of Jesus is the better mediator of a better covenant. But in verse 16, the author is going to answer a question implied in that question. Well, why did Jesus have to die to be the mediator? If why did he have to die to ratify the new covenant? If blood is all that's required here, a more perfect sacrifice, an unblemished sacrifice, not just unblemished externally, but unblemished internally, if all that was needed was this blood, why didn't Jesus just bleed? Why did he have to die? Why is death? Why did he have to suffer? And so he explains this in verses 16 through 17. Now we come to the 16 and 17, we run in to some interpretive issues that have kind of been an issue with biblical expositors for quite a long time. And the whole debate, the issues, center on the interpretation of the word covenant in verses 16 and 17. Diatheke is the Greek word. And sometimes in secular Greek writings, the word diatheke, covenant, is often translated will or testament, like last will and testament. That's its secular Greek meaning. So there are some Bible expositors who want to give it this meaning. Or you have those who want to render this word covenant as covenant, just as the Septuagint, to the Greek translation of the Old Testament, renders it. The Hebrew word berit is covenant. This is the kind of the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew word berit, covenant. Well, there's three main interpretations, three main ways in which expositors have looked at this, so we'll just familiarize ourselves with them a little bit, just so you know kind of where the better argument lies here. And that is, the first interpretation is really the majority view. This is the view that the vast majority of Bible expositors, a lot of commentaries, will take. And that is, they interpret the word covenant in verses 16 and 17 as will or testament. But in verses 15 and verses 18, they'll interpret the word covenant as covenant. And so they change the meaning in verses, they interpret it in 16 and 17 as will and testament, but as covenant in 15 and 18, essentially giving it a double meaning. And why do they do that? Well, because in verses 16 and 17, the author of Hebrews tells us that in order for this covenant to be valid, the person who made it has to die. And so, well, what other kind of covenant is there? What other kind of will is there that's only valid when the person dies? That's like the last will and testament. But there's some serious problems with this view. First of all, this interpretation of applying this Greek understanding, this Hellenistic understanding or rendering of covenant as will, it's incongruous with any known Hellenistic Greco-Roman legal system. See, a Hellenistic will, a Greek will, was valid when it was made, when it was signed, when it was witnessed, and when it was deposited or filed. That's when it became valid, not necessarily when the person died. In fact, a person's estate could be distributed even while they were still living, so death didn't actually have to occur. So that's one of the serious problems with interpreting this as will or testament. Secondly, there's some grammatical difficulties. In verse 16, it says where their covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. And actually, the words translated there, be the death, is translates the word Pharaoh in the Greek, which actually means to bring, to carry. Carry a report, carry a claim. It doesn't mean to report a death or confirm a death. So, you have to give the Greek word Pharaoh there a different connotation than what it normally applies within its other translation, or the way it's normally translated within the Bible. Another problem with interpreting covenant as testament is that everywhere the word covenant occurs in Hebrews, and it occurs in Hebrews more than any other New Testament book, 17 out of 33 times in the New Testament, it occurs in Hebrews. 15 times just in chapters 7 through 10, where the author of Hebrews is talking about the superiority of Jesus' high priesthood. And wherever it appears in Hebrews, it always means covenant, not will or testament. And so we have these problems here with trying to interpret this as the word covenant as will or testament. The second interpretation interprets the word diatheke as covenant. And again, this is a minority view. But the way they interpret it, they tend to paraphrase these verses, verses 16 and 17. In other words, they're saying that where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. They're seeing the death there is symbolical, because under the old covenant system, under the ritual system, when a covenant was made, an animal was sacrificed, therefore death had to occur in order for the covenant to be valid. And so, for this, there, if you're going to have a covenant, there's a necessity, has to be a death. And this death has to be accomplished by one who is entering into this covenant. And that death is typically of an animal. So the animal represents the covenant maker, and essentially saying, if I violate this covenant, may it be done to me as it was done to this animal. Well, there's a couple of problems with this interpretation. Not as many problems as the first, but first, not all covenants were ratified by the ritual killing of an animal within the Old Testament. It was actually the oath that was implicit in the sacrifice of the animal that was more important, not so much the sacrifice as it was the oath. And also, it seems as though the author of Hebrews here in verses 16 and 17 is speaking of an actual death, not just a symbolic death. Which brings us to the third interpretation, and which I think is the most accurate, and it's not only with the language, but also with the broader context of Hebrews. And that is where diatheke should be translated covenant, but in particular it should be referring to the Mosaic covenant, the covenant that was made on Mount Sinai. So in verse 16 says, for where a covenant is, that covenant is referring to the Mosaic covenant. And it's telling us why death is necessary for the forgiveness of the sins. Because where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. See, that word where in verse 16 is probably better translated since. Since a covenant is, in other words, since this covenant has been made, this Mosaic covenant, there must of necessity, the person who made it must bear the penalty of the covenant. Where a covenant exists, the breach of the covenant demands death. The death must be borne, must be carried, which gives a better sense of that word Pharaoh, which means to carry, to bear, so that the where the covenant is, and where there exists a covenant, and if there's a breach of the covenant, a death has to occur. And it's the death of the one who entered into the covenant, the one who made it. This is why there has to be a death of the mediator. And then verse 17 just reinforces this point. For a covenant is valid only when men are dead. For it is never enforced while the one who lives it made. What's he talking about there? Well, when he says the covenant is valid, literally it means firm or secure. The covenant is firm or secure when, and what's translated when men are dead is literally on the dead or over the dead or upon the dead. So this is what killing the animal signified. This is what took place at the ratification of the old covenant. Animals were sacrificed. Blood was sprinkled. It was validated. It was affirmed when these animals were killed, were dead over, or done over people. And it's never enforced while the one who made it lives. See, the death for covenant breakers is mandatory. It's inherent within the covenant itself. Now, this interpretation is consistent with all of Hebrews. See, in chapter 2, verse 2, that the first covenant brought the curse of death. For if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense, so it brought death. Transgression of the covenant brings death. Chapter 10, verse 28. If anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony or two or three witnesses, violation of the first covenant brings death. We're also told that Christ, Jesus, is the one who takes the curse of the law on himself. Again, in chapter 2, verse 9. But we do see him who has been made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. So he takes the curse of the law on himself. What are we told in Galatians? What does Paul write in Galatians? Galatians chapter 3, verse 13. That Jesus tasted death for everyone. That Jesus, actually he's quoting the Old Testament in Galatians 3:13, that Christ became a curse for us. Because cursed is everyone who dies on a tree. Cursed is everyone who violates the law. And Jesus became the curse for us. He takes the curse of the law on himself. He also frees those who are under the curse of the law. We've been told this in Hebrews already, chapter 2, verse 15. They might deliver those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. He frees those who are under the curse. Chapter 10, verse 14. For by one offering he is perfected for all time those who are sanctified. And he provides a new and a better covenant through this death, through this sacrifice. So he draws a conclusion from this. Verse 18. Here's the conclusion. Therefore, actually the word is better translated, this is why, whence, wherefore. This is why even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. This is why the Mosaic covenant was inaugurated with a bloody ritual to emphasize the curse, to emphasize the curse for disobedience. This is what happens when you violate the covenant you've made with God. And then he just confirms this. He validates this claim that the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood by going back to Exodus. He summarizes what took place, what we saw earlier, Exodus 24. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves and goats. Actually, the words and goats shouldn't be in there. That's was probably added by a later scribe. Most original manuscripts just have calves. And with water and scarlet, wool and hyssop, and if we went back to Exodus 24, we would see that water and scarlet and wool and hyssop were not included in what Moses did. He just sprinkled blood. No mention of water, scarlet wool, and hyssop, although hyssop was used what to sprinkle the blood with. And he sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you." See, blood inaugurated the covenant. He sprinkled the people. And what was the response of the people to this covenant? Oh yeah, we'll obey. We'll obey everything that's in here. We'll do it. We'll obey it. Over in 1 Peter chapter 1, Peter uses some interesting terminology and when referring to the Christians that he's writing to. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who are chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father by the sanctifying work of the Spirit, that you may obey Jesus Christ and be sprinkled with His blood. How are Christians, in what sense are Christians sprinkled with His blood? Well, of course, symbolically. But still, that is part. You're part of a new covenant now. You've been brought into a covenant. This covenant is confirmed with you. It's inaugurated the covenant. And as a partaker of this new covenant people, obedience is the only proper response. We've been called to obey Jesus Christ and be sprinkled with His blood. That's part of being within a covenant relationship with God. So this is why the people that Peter was writing to were scattered around. They were at odds with the world. But they're sanctified. They're set apart. They're purified. And they're set apart and purified. Why? For obedience. Isn't this what he just said up in verse 14? That our conscience is cleansed from dead works. Why? To serve the living God. So when you're brought into this new covenant relationship with Christ, all those who are called, all those who are chosen, are brought into this relationship. They've been sprinkled with the blood of Christ, which means they're set apart, they're sanctified, they're purified, they're cleansed. And they're cleansed, why? To be in a covenant relationship with God, to live in that relationship, and that is a relationship of obedience to Him. And then he just goes on, expanding on this thought of the purification with the blood. In the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with the blood. In other words, virtually everything associated with the Old Covenant worship was purified with blood. It was set apart. It was sanctified. It was holy. But why are the vessels in the temple called holy? And they're inanimate objects. Why are they holy? Well, it's because they're set apart, sanctified for specific use. And that's the only use they are to be used for. They're holy, set apart, sanctified. I mean, when we look at the Old Testament system here, it is a bloody, bloody system, wasn't it? I mean, this is just rivers of blood going constantly. But it was all to drive home the point that sin brings death. You're in need of cleansing. You're in need of purification. So everything, essentially, was cleansed with blood. And this is what he says in verse 22. And 22 is really a transitional verse into verses 23 through 28, which we'll get to the next time. But in 22, according to the law, one may almost say all things are cleansed with blood. In other words, under the Old Covenant, all the Mosaic law, almost everything that needed purifying had to be purified with blood. There were a few exceptions. If you were too poor to even have buy a turtle dove to sacrifice, or a couple of birds, you could bring a grain offering, you could bring a flower or a meal offering. Weapons, gold, the spoils of war, things that were captured from the enemy, could be purified with fire or with water. But these exceptions are rare. The general rule, which he repeats, all things, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. That's the general rule. There's no forgiveness, there's no purification, there's no redemption without the shedding of blood. So this is why salvation apart from Christ is impossible. And we have so many people out there today saying that you don't have to believe in Jesus to be saved, or you can, or your Jesus is just as good as my Jesus, and we can believe in whatever Jesus we want. But it has to be the Jesus of the Bible. It has to be the one who sacrificed, the one who redeemed us, the one who purchased us. Salvation apart from Christ is impossible. This is why Jesus' death was necessary. Was necessary. Because the violation of a covenant requires death. And the only one who could meet God's righteous requirements was a perfect Savior. So this is why it was necessary for Jesus to die. Absolutely necessary. Now along these lines, I just wanted to make you aware of a couple of views out there concerning the atonement. There's been a view around actually since a very, very early church that was advanced by people like Thomas Aquinas and even into Calvin, even seemed to adhere to this particular view, but it's a view known as a hypothetical necessity. In other words, is there any other way God could have saved mankind other than the death of Jesus? And a lot of these theologians will say, well, he could have saved some other way, but he didn't, because he had already determined this was the best way to do it. And so he already, since this was what would manifest his love the most, manifest his grace the most, this is what God chose to do. Out of all these options, out of all the ways God could have saved, this is the way he chose to save. There were other options available to him. He could have saved without the death of Christ, but he didn't. And that's what's known as a hypothetical necessity. Hypothetically, it was necessary, but there could have been other ways that Jesus could have chosen. What are some problems with that that you can think of, or off the top of your head? Long pause. Just to wake you up. I mean, is there a... Well, in a bigger sense, it does, yeah. Yeah, that's one of the major arguments against it, was if there were any other optional way, why the death of his son? You know, how can God be the most loving being if he would kill his son when there were other ways to redeem mankind? And if the giving of his son was an expression of his love, but yet there were other ways to redeem man, why did he give his son? How could that be an expression of his love? So yeah, so the hypothetical necessity really puts a smear on God's character. And so to counter that view, there's a view that's known as the consequent absolute necessity. You know, I love all these theological terms. Consequent absolute necessity. Now, the word consequent there means essentially that God determined to save mankind. And as a consequence of that determination, where He determined to save some men, and out of that determination, it became absolutely necessary, based on His character of who He is, that this is the way He saved them, by giving His Son. So He determined to save some, and as a consequence of that determination, He must absolutely necessary save in this way because of His own nature. And a little book by John Murray, Redemption Accomplished and Applied, talks about this consequent absolute necessity in the early part of the book. But just some reasons why this view of the atonement, that, because we're told here, this is what the author of Hebrews is trying to convey here, is why did Jesus have to die? Why did He have to die to become the mediator? Is it absolutely necessary that Jesus died? And even the whole book of Hebrews seems to point to this fact that it was absolutely necessary. Chapter 2, verse 10. For it was fitting for Him for whom are all things, and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to perfect the author of their salvation through suffering. And in verse 17, therefore He had to be made like His brethren in all things, that He might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. See, He had to be made this way. It was a necessity. Actually, that word had there is the same word we looked at last Sunday in John's Gospel, ophelo, which is a debt. It's an obligation. He was obligated to be made like His brethren. This is the only way redemption could be accomplished. In chapter 9, again, just where we are in verses 23 and 24. It was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be cleansed by these. See, it's necessary. Also, another reason why it's absolutely necessary is just because of the nature of sin. See, every sin is an infinite sin because it's sin against an infinite God. It's an infinite offense against a holy, holy God. And an infinite sin requires infinite retribution. And the only one who can atone for that sin, the only one who can satisfy infinite righteousness, is infinite righteousness. You know, and the only one who can do that is God Himself, Jesus Christ. This is why He had to die. Even John 3:16, God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him shall not perish but have everlasting life. In other words, the only alternative to eternal punishment is God giving His Son. Right? There is no other alternative. Another reason for the absolute necessity is that we, as Christians, we as people, as fallen people, in order for anybody to be accepted by God, you got to be perfect, right? A holy God cannot accept an unholy person. We have to be perfect. And we have to be perfect in order to be justified by God. We can never be perfect. We can never offer our own works to be justified by God. We can never have our good works outweigh our bad works. So we need a righteousness that's alien to ourselves, that's foreign to ourselves. That's the righteousness of Christ. It's imputed to us. And it's when that's imputed to us, then God justifies us because we appear clothed in the righteousness of Christ. So it was necessary. And again, just what we'd already have said, why would God give His Son if it wasn't absolutely necessary? That would make God a cruel, not a loving Father. But probably the biggest reason why it was absolutely necessary is just because, and this goes with what was said, the sovereignty of God. And by sovereignty, it's we're talking about His immutability, His eternal purpose, His eternal decree. See, to say that God could have done something other than what He had already decreed to do is to say that God could change, that God could be, that God's decree is mutable, not immutable. But if something could be other than it is, then that means that it's not immutable and it's not eternal. It's also to say that God could be other than He is. See, to say that, well, God could have done it different. God could have done it this way. God could have done it that way. We hear people say this all the time. Why did God do it this way? Why does God make the world this way? Why did God create things the way they are? Well, because He chose to. It was His immutable decree, eternal decree, because this is the way God is. See, if God could be a God who could not create, He would not be the God of the Bible. If God could be a God who could not save, or could choose not to save, He wouldn't be the God of the Bible. Or if He could be the kind of God who could choose to save differently than He chose to save, then He's not the God of the Scripture. See, it was necessary for Jesus to die, to become the mediator of a better covenant, to redeem us because of God's eternal decree. He had to do it this way because it's the way God decreed in eternity past. From all eternity, it's in the very nature of God. And it had to be done in this way because of God's character, of who He is, His holy nature, His righteous nature, and His justice. So, how people think about the atonement makes a huge difference in the way they think about God and how they view God and not all, and how they view salvation. So, it was necessary for Jesus to do this, to cleanse our conscience from dead works, to sprinkle us with His blood, to become the mediator of a better covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance, eternal life. It's promised in the new covenant.